Welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Juliana, and this is the show where I review every single book that I read as I read it.
No, you don't. It's not every single book. It's every single science fiction and/or fantasy. My name is Luke Burridge, and I'm Juliana's boyfriend, and we do this show together. Well, anyway, that was an interesting start. I thought it'd be funny if you did the introduction because You did quite well. You almost got the introduction exactly right because Juliana's been on, like, this is now the fifth podcast in a row that you've done with me, mainly because I've read some other books but not got around to reviewing them by myself.
You're lazy.
I'm not lazy. I'll get to it sometime. I'm just working on other stuff, working on other projects. So today we're going to continue on with our culture, Ian and Banks culture read-along book club thing that we're doing, where as we go through all of the culture books in order, well, not in the publication order, in my order, in our order of reading. But first of all, because it's 2014, 2013 is up. On the beginning of the last episode, we talked a little bit about some of our favourite movies and science fiction movies of last year. But then we thought, well, we'll look back through and share our top five science fiction novels each.
Yes.
Yes? So, first of all, let me just quickly go across the Goodreads listeners group, where other people have been, the Goodreads SFBRP listener discussion group, and it's on the in the thread, top five everything. So let's just go through some of top fives from this year. Back in November, Moedelhoff wrote, top five books I read in 2013, Wool by Hugh Harry, Chasm City by Alistair Reynolds, House of Suns by Alistair Reynolds, Spin by Robert Charles Wilson, and The Chrysalids by John Wyndham. And I was like, wait. It's still 2013. We still have like a month of reading to go. You can't just like discount 1/12 of all the books you're going to read. So that was his list as well. He actually changed it a bit later. He put The Man in the High Castle up there as well, and the other ones dropped off. Jeff said, Wool, Day of the Triffids, Dust, Hunger Games, and The Chrysalids. Otto says, top five science fiction books read in 2013. The Prestige by Christopher Priest. Heroes Die by Matthew Woodring Stover, which I don't know. The Anubis Gate by Tim Powers. That's the one that you were wanting to find, wasn't it?
Yes.
The Tales of the Dying Earth, or the Dying Earth Tales, or whatever. There's different names for that series by Jack Vance. And Hyperion by Dan Simmons. Alexander said, Embassy Town, Inverted World. That's by China Mieville. Inverted World by Christopher Priest. Dimensions of Miracles by Robert Sheckley. Beggars in Spain by Nancy Kress. And Gothic High Tech by Bruce Sterling. There's a few more lists here. Stop typing so loud here. So Jeff says The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch, which I have reviewed on this podcast. Caliban's War by James S.A. Corey. 2312 by Kim Stanley Robinson. The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. And Use of Weapons by Ian and Banks, which we're actually doing this time out, aren't we? And there was Ryan picked quite... He did a huge long list. He did his... novels that he's read for the first time in 2013, top five newish or science fiction novels that he's read for the first time, you know, so like classic stuff he's read for the first time, new novels he's read for the first time in 2013, and then some literary speculative fiction plus fantasy and horror. So I thought I'd do a little bit in like a combination of that list there as well, you know, sort of like best books that I've read in 2013, or science fiction books that I've read in 2013, but also best new science fiction, or at least science fiction that I've read for the first time in 2013. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because so many of the books that I rate so highly, again, as we were talking about last time out when we were talking about the movies, the best science fiction movies we've seen, only Gravity was made this year, or was a recent release, and all the rest of them were from, like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, in the case of Jurassic Park and stuff like that. So let's start off, let's go to one of your lists, your top books. You've just been actually updating it here.
Yeah, I just updated it because, for some reasons, I went on my Goodreads page where I had, like, marked all the books read, and then I sorted them by date. Read.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, then they are all then nice sorted and I can see which books I read in 2013. And I must have overseen.
What?
Overseen? No.
Missed out?
Missed.
Overlooked.
Overlooked.
Yeah, overlooked. It. Yeah, that's the good way of translating that.
That's a direct translation from German into English, which doesn't work. Anyway, so I must have overlooked The Man in the High Castle, and because I really, really enjoyed that one.
Oh, okay. I
had to put it in my list because otherwise that wouldn't have been.
Yeah, I didn't use my Goodreads list for updating it, which is probably a bad idea. I should have done that. Instead, I just looked at the SFBRP website. If you go to sfbrp.com and click on the episode lists link, it actually shows all of the books that I've reviewed in the order I reviewed them, and organized by author and organized by star rating as well. So I just got that list, just copied out the books that I read in 2013 or reviewed in 2013, let me put it that way, and then sorted them by star ratings. And also I included the books that I read for the SFF audio podcast and some shorter novellas, which I didn't review in podcast form at all. So, okay, let's start with you then. Books that you've read this year, you were just explaining some one that you missed off your list here.
Yes.
Okay.
So the most of the books that are on this list I read...
For the first time.
For the first time, except one. So, let's start. So, the first one, like, I try to make it in the order I actually would rate it.
It's the top five. You might as well list them in order.
I don't know if I actually rated all of them in the right... if I picked them, like, five stars, four stars, three stars.
But
I don't know. But
quite a few of these. I'm looking at a list.
Remember.
You gave them five stars anyway.
So, the first one would be The Man in the High Castle.
No. Go count down. Do a countdown.
Oh, sorry.
You've just given it away. Blown it.
Well... Can you edit it?
No. Just keep going.
Okay.
I don't edit.
I couldn't really decide. So I have actually six books from last year. So I start with the sixth, which is The Day of the Triffids.
Good choice.
I really enjoyed
by
that.
John Wyndham. Yeah. Yes. That's actually John Wyndham and The Chrysalids is on quite a few of these other people's top five lists as well. So maybe we should get around and read The Chrysalids sometime.
Yeah, we should see.
I've already reviewed it, I think, on the podcast. So we should check it out.
So the fifth is The Play of Games.
Yeah, number five.
Which we also just reviewed.
But this is the only one that you've read before, isn't it? Because you read that a few years ago, didn't you?
Not a few years
ago. Last year. Oh, no, 2 years ago or something.
2011 or something.
Yeah, but that was we read that again because of the Ian M. Banks Culture Series read-along, which was this podcast is for, yeah.
Yes. Number four is Rendezvous with Rama.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that one. For it's just simple, really good science fiction and just pure and very... very intelligent human interaction.
Yep, okay.
The third is a bit of cheating because I've put an omnibus in there, which is Cordelia's Honor, which is combined Barrier and... Shards of Honor.
Okay.
And Barrier, because these two books were, like, super, like...
Yeah, it's a continuation of a story. I think they were, like you said, they were written as one story.
Yes, and just then...
Split apart for publication
so
reasons.
So this is why I really, really enjoyed that.
Yep.
And then number two is The Prefect.
By Alistair Reynolds.
For obvious reasons, we reviewed that one, really enjoyed it.
Yep.
And number one...
is The Man in the High Castle, which you gave away before by Philip K. Dick.
Oh, well.
Now, okay, so let me get across to my list. This actually works out because if you just take out Player of Games, you've actually got a top five there because Player of Games is the only book in that list that you've read before. My list, the thing is, if I actually just picked the top books that I've read this year just by, just by the ratings, there'd be Player of Games, Man in the High Castle, The Prefect, Solaris, Day of the Triffids. Now, I've already got five books there, which are, like, within the top six, but I've read all of those before. So I'm thinking, okay, well, that's just by going with my star ratings. But, of course, like, these are some of my five-star books, like Player of Games, Man in the High Castle. These are some of the only books that I've ever given five stars to. Like, why wouldn't I be reading them more than once, you know? Why wouldn't I go back to some of my favourite books and review them? Some of them I reviewed twice, like The Prefect and... I think I reviewed Solaris twice and Day of the Triffids twice. No, not Day of the Triffids. I can't even remember. But yeah, anyway, I've reviewed quite a few of these. Right. So if I just pick books that I read for the first time in 2013, suddenly it becomes really tricky. So I got Cloud Atlas in there, which I really enjoyed. The Great North... Oh, that's by David Mitchell. The Great North Road by Peter F. Hamilton. Then I have Shards of Honor, which I rated four stars, or we rated together four stars. We both really enjoyed that. I think I'd actually... I can't remember if I reviewed that one with you or without you, but... I think I'd read both those books,
and then
I said, hey, you should start reading along with me.
Exactly. I think I started in with Barrier.
Yes, which was like the follow-up, wasn't it? So Shards of Honor, I wasn't expecting to enjoy at all, and I was really impressed with that. It was exactly the kind of thing I want from science fiction. And then, after that, there's loads more books that I've read before, like... The Hobbit and Harry Turtledove's World War in the Balance, only the first book in that series. I actually read the second book in that series this year, but I combined the review into one podcast, World War II, I think it's Tilting the Balance or Setting the Balance or Something in the Balance by Harry Turtledove. And then the other books that were like Cloud Atlas would be, you know, Cloud Atlas, Great North Road, and Shards of Honor would all be sort of like near the top, like as like a 1, 2, or 3. I'm not quite sure of books that I'm reading for the first time. But then underneath that, there's quite a lot of books which I read for the first time, which would all kind of be in roughly the same area. For example, like The Darwin Elevator and by Jason M. Hoff and Neil Asher's The Skinner. Both of them pretty good military science fiction-y kind of things.
Yeah.
Why not? But, like, I wouldn't... Like, if you had to say which one of those is better, I have no way to pick which one is better or which one I enjoyed more. You know, it's always subjective star rating. So I can't really say I've got a fixed top five of books that I read for the first time.
Yeah.
In 2013. But anyway, I think we've got some good lists. We've got some good top five.
If you'd pick, like, out of all the books, even the ones that you already read... would you go with like with the star rating as you have it there, and would put,
yeah,
like...
probably I'd go. I probably have Man in High Castle as my top book that I read this year.
In reverse.
Oh, in reverse. Come on. Well, I don't have a reverse. I don't have a reverse. But of course, Man in High Castle, Player Games, and Prefect, and Solarist, and I'm not sure if I'd put Day of the Triffids above something like. Again, Great North Road. I think it's a book that I enjoyed more than is a good
because
book.
Because
I could follow along. I just, it's either you've got to really like Peter F. Hamilton or have lived in Newcastle or really like detective stuff mixed with aliens and alien and, references to the movies and, like I say, being in Newcastle and all the kind of stuff. And it was like a best of Peter F. Hamilton for me and... set in a place where I'd lived before, plus other things that made it personally good for me. Anyway, so I don't recommend that to everyone because it's just such a big book. But then again, I quite like big books. So that's it. Oh, I just wanted to go through some numbers. So I in total read 38 novels. In fact, actually, some of those are novellas and science fiction collections. And there's even Saga, which was a comic book as well. But anyway, 38 science fiction and fantasy books read. And then I... there was a few authors who I read multiple books by. One was Harry Turtledove, 2 books of his. Alistair Reynolds, 2 books of his. And actually, that counts... that counts On the Steel Breeze, which I haven't actually reviewed yet. Joe Abercrombie, I finished off a series of his. That's 2 books. Philip K. Dick, 2 of his books. Peter F. Hamilton, a big chunky book plus a short story collection. Ian M. Banks, 3 novels. And then Lewis McMaster Bujold, 5 novels. So Ian M. Banks and Lewis McMaster Bujold kind of wrapped up like the good and the bad of my science fiction, you know, series reading in 2013, because all the way down, which only got 1.75 stars out of 5, which is the lowest rating book that I read this year, is The Vor Game by Lewis McMaster Bujold. And it only got a higher rating because I think you liked it a bit more than me and we averaged it out, you know, because otherwise I'd never give a 0.75 rating. I think I gave it 1.5 stars and you gave it 2 stars. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, a low rating that we gave there. But then... you know, Shards of Honor, 4-star book. It's in like my top 5 of the first books read of the year. So anyway, I think that's enough of that. Should we get on to our real topic for today?
Yes, the real topic,
which is
use of weapons.
Use of weapons, and in German it is called
Einsatzwaffen.
You have it right there. You got the Wikipedia page right there. Yeah. I thought you'd be able to click straight across to that. So we're reading this in order. Because you just mentioned the German version, how was the German translation? Because you read it as a German ebook, didn't you?
Yes, because the German ebook was an omnibus that I got in 2012, I think, when I and it combines the play of games and use of weapons one after the other.
Yeah,
and I compared to, like, for example, Accession or Consider Flippers.
Yeah,
I think the translation is a lot closer to the English, because first of all, the English word drone is actually translated correctly into German
as what?
Drohne.
Yeah, not robot.
Not robot.
Yeah, okay.
So because there was one issue we had when in Accession or no?
Yeah, well, talking about it when
Consider Flippers.
We talked about it when we reviewed the Prefect as well, because they were called. They weren't called droids, they were called servitors or something like that.
Yeah, servitors and, like, all these different names.
We had that conversation before,
machines with brains.
But you bought this. You bought this ebook when you were like when you first started kind of saying, "Hey, you read a lot of science fiction. I want to read more science fiction. Tell me some science fiction books to read." And I was like, "Well, you know, Play of Games. Why not? Why not start there?" Yeah. And because you got Play of Games and it came with Use of Weapons. Use of Weapons was the second culture book that you read, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And already then, I totally understood where you said, don't read Use of Weapons first.
Yes.
And read Play of Games first to just actually understand and get into it.
Yeah.
Which was really a really good hint, I think.
But also... Karen.
But then, because I read these two books one after the other, I really enjoyed... already in at that time, I really enjoyed Use of Weapons then.
Mm.
And I already gave it quite a high rating. Because I just had really a lot of fun reading it.
Yeah, it's a good fun book.
Yes.
But I think the second read-through is when you really go, you get your head around the structure and stuff. We'll talk about that in a second.
It was quite let's say it's about a year or more than a year.
Probably about 18 months or something. Yeah,
something like this. And I must admit, the big twist at the end, I just totally forgot about it.
Well, I think the genius part about the twist at the end of this book, which we'll get onto later, we'll go into more details later on, but the big twist at the end of this book is so good because the rest of the book is so good that it doesn't rely on that twist there.
It's convincing. I mean, you the whole time you just read something and you think, that was it. Mm, yeah.
But there's some like, say, just to bring up twisty things, we might as well talk about movies, but there's like a movie like The Sixth Sense.
Yeah,
which
is always my
yeah, I'm just saying this, but it is a twist movie. It is a twist story.
Yes.
There's nothing about the rest of the story which really stands out. I mean, it's a well-made movie, but there's nothing about it which stands out.
No, it's all about the twist.
It's all about the twist and the usual suspects. It's just quite a bland, forgettable story with the usual suspects until the twist, and then it's elevated into something greater.
Yeah.
I think with Use of Weapons, it's a really, really good book, and everything is really great, and then there's the twist at the end, and then you go, oh, but I don't think the twist at the end makes it better or worse if you don't like the twist, or believable or not believable. It's just yet another really great element, because it isn't the main focus of the story.
Yes, I think so too. It is nothing that makes the entire book that you've read before makes it totally different.
Yeah.
It's just another of these very clever clever things that Ian Banks is doing there. Apart from the whole how the story is constructed,
and apart from everything else in the book,
apart from the characters, and apart from from plots and all this stuff.
Okay.
It's just another element that makes it really enjoyable.
So before we actually talk about what that twist is, we want to mention now that this is a read-along series. I mean, this culture reading series that we're doing, the idea is that you're reading along through these books, either in the same order that we've read them all before, or you read them before, you know. So we're going to go full spoilers with this review. If you want to if you want to listen to a review of this book when I reviewed it the first time, I think it was like back in... episode 18? Well, actually, I guess I can just bring it up here, because there's a I have a list, the list of books here. So I reviewed this back in Use of Weapons was back in episode number 26. So go listen to episode 26 if you want a non-spoiler review of this. Otherwise, we're going to go full spoiler right from pretty much now. So
we should have gone for 126 now for this episode.
Yeah, we should have.
Quite funny.
Yeah, read it 100. Cause, I mean, I read it for I started the Science Fiction Book Review podcast in 2008. And so they were now 6 years later. I think it's okay to read this again.
How often did you read it then?
This is my first time since 2008. And I'd read it once before.
So you read it twice.
So this is my third reading of it.
Oh, it's your third. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, and if you don't want to listen any further on, if you don't want to get the spoilers, we're both recommending this book very highly, especially if you read it in this point of the, in our read-through. Anyway, so what are we getting up to now? I read this book as an ebook. I'd read it before twice as a paper book. This time I read it as an ebook, but also I downloaded an audiobook version. I tried getting a legal copy. In the end, there was nowhere for me to legally purchase any way to download this, and I'm not going to start, you know, ordering CDs and stuff. So I did pirate a version of this book, and it's not read by
Peter Kenny.
Is it Peter Kenny who did the other books? It wasn't read by him. It felt very much like a very straight reading, like a books on tape reading. The guy, like the reader, I was actually going to make a note of who the reader was, but I can't remember because it, you know, I didn't download it from a place. I just got it as a torrent. So I can't remember who was reading. It was a good enough reading, but it was nothing special. And I really, and what I really wanted was the Peter Kenny take on this, because I know this is already going to be a good book, but I really wanted it to be performed for me by a really good reader. And that just wasn't the version I listened to. So I would read, I'd say probably about 80% of it as an ebook, maybe 75-80% of it. But then the rest of it I listened to as an ebook, which I enjoyed enough. Again, don't really have much to say about the audiobook because I didn't listen to the whole thing, so I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever. So let's get into this. We're part of the way through our listening thing. We're about halfway through. No, this is the fourth book. So you've done Play of Games, Consider Phlebas, Accession, and Use of Weapons. The reason why I want to put Use of Weapons a bit later is that I didn't want it to follow Consider Phlebas, or to be directly before or after Consider Phlebas, because they're both quite heavy.
I understand that.
They're
yes.
quite heavy.
Yes.
Even though there's a lot of really fun stuff in this book, just overall, like if you read Consider Phlebas and then go straight into Use of Weapons, you pretty much want to kill yourself at the end of it, because you're thinking there are no happy endings, whereas Accession in the middle, where it makes you go, yay, spaceships and drones flying around and doing fun stuff. You know,
yeah.
there's some fun stuff in there. But also, I wanted to like use this as like, Play of Games is from the point of view of a normal culture person who's working for special circumstances, but he's a normal culture person. He's from the inside of the culture. Consider
yes.
Phlebas is from an enemy from outside of the culture. And then the Accession is from the point of view of mostly about the ships and the drones. You know,
yeah.
it's more a mechanical thing. But the use of weapons is then from the point of an outsider being used by contact and special circumstances, but not as an enemy, but as a human weapon. I mean, I was going to say that as like as a tool by
yeah.
the thing. I'm kind of giving away all the whole themes of this, of the use of weapons.
I mean, it's called use of weapons.
I know, so I might as well say it's a human being, but it's also taken away from the view, like Accession, you're sort of like the views, these massive views of like wide-ranging, far distance seeing into the distance and into the future of the ships that are flying around.
Yeah.
And it's very inhuman. It's very logical. It's very, okay, now we'll plan and do this, and now we'll do this, and now we'll do this, and now we'll do this, and you guys over there do this and that, and it's, you know, all very controlled. What I love about this, it takes it down to the human level, and we see what it's like.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, to be a human acting for the culture, but outside of the, most of it's outside of the culture. We get, like, what, one, or, like, we get a little bit with...
I mean, where the times
with
when
Smart.
He's on the ship there, on
and at the beginning when Smart is on the Dizier Smart is on the
when he's like the one of the guys to be.
We haven't even said who yet. I just want to say.
Oh yeah, right.
But like I say, I want to say it brings it down. And there's actually some quotes that I made a note of from the book, like the focus of the novel when they're talking about what special circumstances role is, and it says in the end, actually maybe I could just bring up the full quote here if my iPad turns the right way up here, it says blah blah blah, talking about how they redo things and new beginnings and how special circumstances stuff. It says it all sounded very sophisticated and abstract and challenging to work with, but in the end it came down to people and problems. And this is a book about people and problems. It's not like Accession, where it's a book that comes down to massive spaceships and
to
aliens.
To a problem
yeah.
and spaceship
yeah.
dealing with it.
Yeah, so what it comes down to is we have a problem and we're with people and we need to deal with it, so we use people to deal with it. Because when they're messing with lower level technological level civilizations, they can't just say, okay, let's now just send in a massive spaceship, and the massive spaceship will just, you know, move people around and fix things. You know, like in Accession,
yeah, yeah.
where the spaceship is just like, oh, I need to move all these people, so I'll just displace a million people across here and move the whales over there and move this, literally moving Earth and
atmosphere.
Sky,
yeah, yeah
like
yeah.
that, to solve the problems. When you're dealing with, like, you know, the smaller civilizations, you can't move Earth and Sky to fix the problem. So it's a bit like, you know, the Prime Directive. It's like, okay, we've got to not let them know that they're, you know, that they're the culture or how big the
yeah, and
culture is.
Yeah, it's like
is.
This, what astronauts are taught to never let anything back on the moon or
yeah, yeah.
on Mars or whatever. It's like this untouched, leave everything untouched.
Yeah, but it's not that they... But the point is that the culture don't want to leave anything untouched. They want to leave things better than they found it.
Yeah.
But they can't just go in there with massive technology and solve the problems that way. So it's a bit like, you know, when they... Well, in a way, this is a different approach than the player of games, because in that way it was a very, you know, it was an abstracted, but it was very much like the culture versus the Azad Empire.
Yes.
But instead of fighting it from the outside, they sent in, you know, they sent in a weapon.
And also
the
Azad Empire, although it was lower in certain things,
it was already like
yeah, it yeah. was already quite high up yeah. in how do you call it, civilization yeah. development?
Yeah, technological yeah. development. But what my point is that in here, it's like they send in a human and the human works with other humans to fix human problems.
Yes.
On the human scale. Like, he goes in and helps win a war fought by humans against humans, or he goes in and helps some in some political situation where humans are making decisions with humans. And I think this is one of my favourite novels in the culture series, is because it really brings it down to the human level. Yeah. There is never, oh, what we'll do is just get there faster. And, you know, Ian M. Banks then writes how one spaceship is faster yeah. than everyone else and just gets there faster. It's not that. It's never like a technological solution in that way. It's always human solutions and human problems with human attitudes and human strengths and weaknesses that decide the course of the novel. The exact opposite of Accession, where there are no humans who achieve anything except, like, that one guy with wings. You know,
yes.
that this is the opposite way round. And yes. in the end, the big reveal and the big twist and stuff is a very human in every way.
Oh, yeah, this book is so much psychology.
Yeah, but just say, in the end, it comes down to people and problems. And the big twist at the end, or what the chair is, the answer to what the chair is a people solution to a people problem, you know, in the most like fundamental and basic way.
Yeah,
like the solution, the solution
like
to the solution to the question, what is the chair, why is the chair significant, the solution or the answer to that is people. You know, it's the whole, oh, it's, you know, like the, like we're talking about in the previous, or when was it, the Cloud Atlas, you know, the solid, silent green is people, you know, like the chair is people.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but you don't understand that. But all these clues, and this is why I love this book, reading this book through again, is that you get those lines. In the end, it came down to people and problems. And you're like, well, what are the problems?
People.
It's all people. Yeah. Everything is people. It comes down to people. Let's have a look at another one of the quotes that I think. Let's talk a bit more about the thing.
Maybe we should introduce that, like, yeah. even for people. Like, I mean, we presume that people
yeah.
already read it, but
yeah.
it might be nice to just, instead of talking about him, is actually
okay. Well, let's talk about
who
this.
It is about.
So we get our main culture. Two culture characters, who the only two culture characters we really come across and have it much interactions with, is Dizier Smar, who is our plucky culture special circumstances agent. Even though agent is the wrong word, because they're not ever officially whatever, you know, whatever, in this big, you know, anarchy kind of way that they do, you know, they organize themselves. But she is the agent who has to go around and find some people and do stuff. And this happens in a lot of the culture books.
She's like a person who recruits people.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that in later books we get more of these female characters who have to go around and find stuff or recruit people. You know, okay. it's a recurring character in Ian M. Banks. And actually, Dizier Smar is in the next one that we're going to read, which is the State of the Art. She's one of the main characters in the story State of the Art, which is a short story collection.
Yeah.
But there's like a novella in it called State of the Art, and she's the main character in there. And then we get our drone character, and we've had some really great drones so far. This is Scaffin Amtiscor, who is a really interesting thing. Like, we get introduced to him, where you think, oh, he's going to be a really big part of the story. And by the end, he's not a really big part of the story. But the genius thing is that what you see him, like, how he deals with this military problem or this, you know, this threat at the beginning, how, you know, he just goes and chops people up, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and she's like, no, don't do that anymore. And it's like, okay, I'll mellow out. I won't be like anymore. That is reflected by our special circumstances mercenary called Sheradanin Zakalwi. And there's always an extra syllable in there that I always forget to say. Sheradanin Zakalwi he was not born into the culture because special circumstances always uses agents from outside, the outside of the culture. For example, you remember in Playa of Games, the culture embassy, no, ambassador to Azad. Yeah, yeah. He wasn't even from the culture because they knew that no culture person would be able to go there and they just wouldn't be good enough to survive, you know, in that place.
Yeah, of course.
And that's what was funny about in the Accession. The main character in there was fine of being an ambassador, but like the person, the people who'd been ambassadors before him, like there was one who lasted 4 days and someone else lasted 2 months and he'd been there for like 3 years, fine with it. But they're like, wow, culture people cannot normally do this job,
of course,
but you can.
Because once you've been part of the culture and you've experienced all this hedonistic, free life, enjoying thing, I think it's really, really difficult to go back to like.
Well, it's not about going back to it. It's just being able to deal with them on that, on their level, on their mindset. Like you can't have someone to go in. Oh, there's this civilization over here. They've got like First World War / Second World War technology. You know, they're just getting radios. You know, and they've been given a rocket or something like that.
Yes.
You can't then send in someone who is used to be fighting with you know, like. You know, lasers, plasma rifles. Well, he has a plasma rifle.
No, I'm not even talking about stuff like that. I'm talking about basic human.
Yes, I know what you're talking about. I'm saying there's another level as well. Like, you can't send someone in who is used to culture politics and send them in to Azad and expect them to get through with Azad politics. We saw how that works out. It didn't work out. The only reason he survived was because he was good at the game. Politically, he was stunted, you know, as a stunted great. He just didn't understand what was going on. But of course, he was the right person to send in. The culture knew what they were doing.
Of course, but I'm also talking about the emotional impact that you would have if you come into like suddenly you have war and you have good and bad and you have to decide and you always have to be on one side. I also think this is very much a book of black and white and. Like the whole story and the whole thing about black and white, and also there's grey.
Oh yeah, this is a very grey book.
This is so impressive there. So Sakawi always goes to planets where they have black and white. You always have two parties where he has to kind of, he is working for this side or working for that side, and his life. His whole life is just grey.
Well, but he's put into black and white situations. He is sent in and said, you try and win this war. And he said, okay. And he had this one focus in mind. And it doesn't matter that there's greyness in the motivations. It doesn't matter there's greyness in like who is right or wrong. If he's fighting for one side or the other. If even the side that he's meant to be fighting for is the one that's, you know, the one that's meant to be winning or the one that the culture wants to win in the end. There's a great thing where he had to escort like the idiot king, like this last one of the long line of inbred kings or whatever it was. And he escorts him there and he gets him there successfully. And he's like, well, if it wasn't my job to protect him, I'd have killed him myself.
Yeah,
and in the end, that was his job. He was actually delivering someone to be in the right place to be killed later on, you know.
And also what I think is that Enam Banks is kind of describing, you know, how is this called when stress and post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah, that's what this book is about.
I think this is what, this is really a huge problem that Sakawi has. And also, it's not treated. So it kind of gets worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean when I talk about grayness, because he has all these episodes where I think he has just no fun in life. Like,
no, he does.
I mean,
this is the thing when she says
at
the end of the book
from his job.
Yeah, that's the thing. He has fun. It even says that, like, he tries to become a poet and is really bad at it.
Yeah.
And he tries to go and become a hermit and is really bad at it.
And
he does
work.
This and does that. But then at the end, when he gets sent to this last planet at the end of the book, and like after about a month or something of him setting up the things, he comes around. He's like, and I must admit to myself, he had to admit to himself, he was actually having fun for the first time in like 20 or 100 years. I can't work out the timelines, you know, exactly how far stuff is set at point. So, yes, there's Zakawi is our mercenary who is sent into different situations. So the structure.
This is mainly the guy who we spend time with.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is our people and his problems. This person and his problems is the person and problems that we're spending most time with.
Yeah.
So it starts off that there's a war brewing in this civilization, in this, you know, let's say empire, I can't remember what it is, but in this hegemony or something. Oh no, that was a that was the other side or something. I can't remember. But there was a there's a war thing there, and there's the humanist. And you may think humanists are good, because in our modern world, humanists are good. But in that, in their case, it meant anti-machine intelligences rather than yay humans. It's more like boo machines anyway. Yeah. So, and also terraforming, the culture doesn't like terraforming because they want planets to just evolve and do what they want by themselves naturally. And that terraforming a planet is a waste of that planet, because why don't you just build a big, why don't you build an orbital? Why don't you build a big ring? Why don't you live on a ship? You know, why take over planets which aren't needed? You can just leave them as ground and stuff. Anyway, so they don't want this war in this civilization to come back. So they have to pick up someone who knows the old president, and that's Sakalwi, who fought with the old president before. And the person who they need to track down Sakalwi is his handler, which is Dizier Smar. And so they say, hey, Dizier Smar, you need to go and talk to Sakalwi and pick him up. So it's like, okay. So they go and pick up Sakalwi, and then Sakalwi gets dropped off at this planet, and he has to get in contact with this guy, so on and so forth. That's one course of the story, which is told alternating chapters going forward in time. The other story is Zakalwa's backstory, which we that gets told chapter by chapter in the other alternative chapters going backwards in time. The in the German thing, I noticed that it's called chapter one and then subchapter one, chapter two, subchapter two, or something, was it? Or no, that was the audiobook. Yeah, in the audiobook it said chapter one and then subchapter 13 or something like that. But
just trying to find how they
the Roman numeral chapters go backwards in time, and the normal numerals go forward in time, which is quite a complex structure.
And also, it is difficult to, when you read it, how often do you read, when you read a book, how often do you actually pay attention to what is the title above a chapter? How often do you actually pay attention what it is, if it says number three, or if it says 16 in Roman letters?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing.
I just is skipping that. It says, okay, it's a break, but then it just continues reading.
Yeah. So there you go. Chapter 12 is followed by chapter II.
Yeah, two.
So, well, it's not chapter two, it's chapter II. It's your Roman numeral, so yeah, whatever. But what I, the same thing that you're saying there, that's actually what happened to me the first time I read it. The first time I read it, this book kind of left me a bit cold. And I think it's because it took me about three quarters of the way, or maybe like half of the way through the book, for me to understand what the structure was. And then it was only then when I looked back through it, and then saw the Roman numerals were going in a different direction. And then I was like, but then I couldn't work out which way round they'd gone in my head. So I think that's why I was a bit confused the first time I read
it. So in the German book, they actually just go forward with the those have three parts.
Yeah.
And the three parts are divided into chapters that are called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, to 14. But actually, in the content, they don't mention the Roman numbered...
No, they're not set apart as different
they're
chapters.
They're not set apart. So if I go to, as you just said, to chapter 12, somewhere in between there will be a subchapter with two eyes, like the Roman two.
It isn't
mentioned.
Yeah.
So you can't go to the continent, see yourself, okay, so this goes forward, this goes backwards.
Yeah,
it's just in the book while you're reading it.
And this is, I think, the reason why the reason why the audiobook that I had was for blind people specifically, because it started off contents chapter one, no, like prologue chapter one, chapter I can't remember, but it kind of went through, like, not just it, like the table of contents were read out as well, which was a bit weird at the beginning.
Okay.
So we've got this weird shape where we've got like chapters progressing forward in time and chapters progressing backwards in time. But what I really love about this book is that each one of them reflects on the other one thematically and technologically, and the level where they are technologically. Like when they're traveling on a ship, like when they're traveling on, you know, a culture ship in the forward in time chapters, Zakalwi is going on a ship in his memory. He takes these trips into memories. So it's like these sub chapters. The backwards in time chapters are like his memories being triggered by pertinent events as he goes back through.
Just one question.
What's up?
When in like the in the main forward going chapters, it is from the third point of view, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's an omni.
No, it's always third person.
It, even in the when it's about his memory,
It's a bit more distant. Like in the Backwards in Times one, sometimes it goes, and the man did this, and the man went to the shack, and the man lived on the beach. You know, it takes more of that distance.
Yeah, and also, or sometimes it's even closer, because sometimes it describes something that, like, for example, the drone is doing more specifically than you would have it.
The drone, sometimes we're in the drone's head, which I really like about Ian M. Banks, that he does play with viewpoints in that way. Like we've mentioned in a few of these books now. The other thing that I like is where in the war story, that like in him going backwards in time, he constantly gets, like, it tells of his story fighting in further, like, wars going further and further back through technology.
Yeah.
So by the time you actually get to his roots of his character, when he's fighting his brother or his stepbrother, it's a bit of a weird...
What's his stepbrother?
Yeah, it's his stepbrother. It's a bit of a weird connection there. Like, who has he brought it? You know, there's this guy comes in and he does that. That's quite low technology. But then... in the forward, going forward through time, he goes in with the culture and he goes to this other point, and then he lands on this planet in this broken down spaceship, and they like, Messiah, you need to fight for us. And
I love this. The scene is hilarious.
But it's really funny that they play off each other, because those two things are put next to each other. Like, this is where he started from and this is where he is now. And you realize that it's not just going forward in time and going backwards in time. It's going in this big cycle. You know, he ends up in the same place where the story starts, where it talks about the ship that wasn't a ship, you know, and I'd forgotten exactly what the ship wasn't a ship. You know, I remembered that it was the, what was the name of the ship? Because they...
I don't know. I just know how it's called in German. Stabberind.
Yeah, Stabberind. Yeah, that's it. In English. Because that's the name he takes. And when you get back to the Stabberind, you realize this whole story is kicked off by this, what happens with the Stabberind, and then it ends with him going to visit the Stabberind again. Yeah. But like the loop that he goes around, you know, from higher technology up to the culture and all the wars in between, and then back down the lower technology, down to a low technology war, and that's what puts him into the injured state that he then visits the Stabberind again at the end. It's like a perfect loop.
Yeah.
That the first time you're reading it, you probably won't get, but like I say, in the second and third read-throughs, you're just like, this is really clever, this is really genius.
Also, I think the whole book through, and it has like the peak at the end, where I think he's all the whole way through, he's kind of punishing himself.
Oh, totally.
And it goes up to the last war, where he just goes out in the open battle and just gets like smashed up and
blown around.
Bullets here.
Well, yes, it is self punishment, because he knows that if he lives through it, he's going to have to face his past again.
Yes.
And it's his subconscious mind is like trying to force him away from that kind of stuff. Also, what I like is that even that structure sounds quite complex. Then within those chapters, like within the forward in time chapters, he also has flashbacks to his childhood. And there's some really, really great scenes of him in his childhood, which he doesn't have those flashbacks when he's in the backwards in time. So it's a weird thing. Like so you're having one stuff that goes backwards through his life and forwards in the present time, and then also
you
stories
have flashbacks
told
and dreams.
Yeah,
and then forward going.
Yeah, and then stories from his childhood, and so he's got two sisters plus one stepbrother, and they, you know, have adventures in their house of this, but the house is they obviously like the sons and daughters of someone very important, some military general or prime minister.
Yeah,
but
he's like big politician, I think.
Yeah, but it's kind of military politician in the same way, and so there's all this rivalry going on there, and they're really fun. I really love the scene where they steal the gun, and then someone gets shot with a different gun, and it's like, oh that's clever, and then he carries around, talking about the people problem. He has a problem with in his heart all the time.
Yes,
which is the bit
in
of
his head,
which is in the bit of, no, it's the bit of bone that's stuck above his heart. If you understand what I mean.
Oh yeah, there was the one that right.
And he's like, well, I'll be carrying around that bit of, I'll be carrying around a bit of her in my heart for the rest of, and even that's a, you know, that being the, it's a bit of bone that he carries around, and then what the chair is made of at the end, you know, it's all tied together very well. But then he's like, I'll have her forever. But then at one point his head gets chopped off because he's in this
yeah,
in these
and
savages.
Then he gets a new body.
And he gets a new body growing. And it's so much fun. Like, again, we're talking about this, drab and dreary, and you get to the end and you want to kill yourself. if it was like you want to kill yourself all the way through the book, there wouldn't be any contrast and there wouldn't be any fun stuff. You know, that's why Cloud Atlas was so much fun in the parts where it's quite grim and meaningful, yeah. is because you've also got like the, what is it, the horrific episode of blah-de blah blah, whatever.
Yeah, Tim Cavendish.
Yeah, Cavendish. The ghastly episode or the ghastly adventure of Tim Cavendish. But you need those light moments. So talking about like having a first person narrative or like what it's like to be in the brain of someone who gets their head chopped off and then picked up by the culture. And yeah. I really love the time that at the end of every mission that he gets with the culture, he has to make a sign in the local language. And like sometimes he made it with bodies, didn't he?
Yeah,
he made
out bodies. The last one. Yeah.
And then he made it with in one, he's stranded and his legs are broken, and he makes a warning sign of bird shit at one point, isn't he? In the crater in the middle of the lake, and all the time the culture are looking for him, and they're like, we'll just give you a tracking device, we can track you all the time. And Zakala was like, no, I don't need any of that. I'll just go out.
I'm fine.
So you get these really funny
moments.
And also,
you know what? He's all the time he's playing with suicide. It's so amazing. For example, the one where he is actually on this ship where he gets transferred from one place to the other.
Oh, yeah, the cold sleep ship.
Yeah, the cold sleep ship, where he's up with the two other guys, which are also really good fun. Yeah. Kind of, I don't know what I should think about these two guys, but that's something different. So he is in that elevator thing.
Yeah.
And then he has this torch where he then does this, I mean, this is what
it's like a balance game. Yeah.
When this points to me, then I do that. If it doesn't, I don't do it. And then he says, when the torch is shining into my eyes and from my head or something, I just put my helmet back on because he's in vacuum.
Yeah, and no, he'll take it off and he'll die.
No. When the light is hitting him, he will put he will stop taking it off.
Yes, that's
and,
it. Yeah.
And the thing is, of course, then the torch. Just
yeah, the battery goes out.
The battery just goes, and the torch is black. And then he thinks, "Oh shit!
Yeah, but
do I have to die now?"
But is that real? Did that really happen like that?
Yeah.
You think? Okay, that's cool.
He's playing with death the whole time.
Yes, but in that one case where he was just like, "Oh," and the torch went off. That's one of those things where you go, well, was that the culture? Did they need him? No, but the culture didn't know he was a great general at that point. And the culture wasn't around at all. So I was like, well, what saved him then? Or was it just luck?
Oh, he was, I thought he was there incognito.
The people on the ship, because he'd taken the different name by that point. He'd taken his brother's name by that point.
No, his sister's, he called him the Darksea or something.
No, but by that point, It wasn't Zakalwi. No, it wasn't Shredderine anymore. It was his brother who he took the identity from. So there's two layers of the identity there.
What?
At the beginning of his story, he has a rivalry with his stepbrother. There is a rivalry between him and his stepbrother.
Yes.
When he killed his sister and sent this chair across, made of bones, to escape that system, and then his brother killed himself by shooting himself in the head.
Yeah.
To escape the system, he then took the name of the other person, of his brother.
No, I'm pretty sure when he's on this...
Yes, but when he's on the ship, he then uses another name.
Yeah.
So he has two fake names. One of them is Sheridan's name, and the other one is this other name that he gives himself. So I'm saying that at that time, the people in the ship with him think he's this one character. But at that time of the story, we as the readers think he's Sheridan Zakalwi. And it isn't him either. Yeah. It's not him either. So there's three different characters there. There's three different personality or three different identifying names that could be attached to that person. The one he gave himself consciously.
Yeah.
But which he thought was unconsciously the names of his sisters. The one that he's given himself unconsciously, which is the name of his brother, not his sisters, and his real name, which is his brother, but I can't remember his brother's name. I should have looked that up.
Ethelmiel.
Yeah. So it's actually Ethelumil. He's unconsciously given him the name Sheridarine, and then he's consciously given himself these other two names, which he thinks he's unconsciously given the names of as his sisters. Do you not understand the layers there?
Yeah. I really hope we don't confuse the listeners there right now.
Well, it's not...
I'm confused.
No, it's not that. But, like, is it What do you think? Do you think it was an accident that Ian M. Banks said that he picks these fake names for himself, that he unconsciously used his two sisters' names as new names for himself while he was travelling incognito, when we later find out that he has unconsciously taken not just the name but the personality of his brother, not his two sisters?
Why do you think it's unconsciously that he took his brother's personality?
Because he didn't, by the end of it, he'd been lying to himself all the time. It was his, in the same way that, like, you know, in The Life of Pi, to get through this traumatic experience, he pretends that there's a tiger with him all the time. And in Slaughterhouse-5, to get through this post-traumatic stress, he creates, like, this alien abduction fantasy out of nowhere from it. It's the same thing. It's dealing with post-traumatic stress or dealing with a traumatic situation by creating a fake identity for yourself and then inhabiting it to the point that it's real. In fact, in The Life of Pi, it's like, well, is it real or not? It doesn't matter if it's real or not. It's just what you believe. Slaughterhouse-5 is a different thing. We've got the same process going on here. Post-traumatic stress or stressful situation making someone create their own reality, and he's flipped his identity across to his brother, or he's taken his brother's identity.
And so what you're saying is that when he's on this ship, on this cold sleep ship, this is actually the first time after, like, this is like the meeting point, where it's the first time that we are supposed to realize that the character that's in the elevator and stuff was the first time that Ithomiel took another personality. And well, then no, it not, goes forward.
I'm not saying, no, because that's not where I'm saying, that's not my point. My point is that him killing himself or pretending to kill himself is him trying to take on what his brother did. You know, his brother killed himself, shot himself.
Yes.
Like that. It's him seeing if he needs to do that as well.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that the light going out at that point, if the light did go out or not, you know, it's one of those things, that, sure, that maybe everything outside of his brain is real, but what's happening inside of his brain isn't trustworthy at that point.
Yes.
In the same way that Billy Pilgrim's wasn't.
The cold sleep ship
is
before he is selected by the culture?
Yes, it's before the culture. Yeah, it's because he's selected by the culture when he... because he's on this iceberg, you know, there's these big tabular icebergs that are floating around and there's battles going on between the icebergs. And he finds out that there's going to be this coup on and he tried stopping it. Okay. And it's because he tried stopping it, then he's cast out in the snow. But because he's tried to stop it, he's the one that the culture pick. They're like, ah, he's the guy we need because he's got a really good brain on him. He's a really good general. He's a really good fighter. But also he's got the political awareness and he's a good egg that we can rely on him and he's going to be the good guy. But we know that he's not. I mean, he doesn't know they're not and the culture doesn't know his true personality.
So to put it a bit in an order, so you have the war on the home planet.
With the Stabberind,
With the Stabberind.
Then he takes the cold sleep.
Then he goes with a cold sleep ship to that place where the other war is taking place.
And there he gets picked up.
And
from
there he gets
the
picked up from the culture.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
And it's that journey in the cold sleep to the cold planet is the transition. It's because he takes this fake name, the fake name of his two sisters. And it's in that journey when he gets to the other end. Yeah. By that time, he's taken on the personality of his good egg brother. You know, he's taken on that, in the coup, I've got to do the best thing and I've got to be a good soldier, but also I've got to be a good person and good political person like his brother was. It's that journey is the transition from one character to the next.
Yes. At the end, I actually had the impression that Sekhalwi at the end, or in his whole like military fighting for the culture, that he's actually a combination of the two.
Yes,
because
he is.
At the beginning, the real Sekhalwi had some things that was described at the beginning that he wasn't really good in fighting with swords and like stuff, and so it is all about, it's again, it's what I say, so, it's this black and white and then putting together into
exactly he's got a gray.
And the whole story is about him being gray, and at the beginning he's black, and then he's white, and then the end he's black, and in the whole middle he's grey.
Well, it's not so much that.
Something
I'm just
like
saying.
This.
I'm saying that there's the brother. What is his?
Ithomiel.
Ithomiel. Anyway, so he is the guy who made a chair out of his sister's bones.
Yeah, really cruel.
And, but Sheridan is he was the guy who wouldn't even attack the ship, not even to the win the war, yeah, because his sister was there and he loved his sister so much. So you've got this, like I say, the good egg and bad egg, you know, like, yeah, the one side, the white side, which is, yeah, it's almost too, he's too good. It's like he could have won the war, but he didn't want to harm the person that he loved who was close to him. And also, he didn't kind of didn't want to kill his brother because he would have had to do that, yeah, as well, even though he had this rivalry.
He didn't want to attack the ship. And then it didn't work, and then they even destroy even more lives. Yeah. I think that was also the point that,
yeah,
although his sister was in there, he didn't want to attack it because then more people would have died, yes, including his sister.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you say, it's a bit too innocent.
But that's what I think, that's the cool thing, is like, oh, he wasn't very good with this, and he wasn't so good with shooting, or he wasn't so good with swords, but he was good with thinking and, yeah, tactics and things. And you're like, oh, that's, oh, so he's come a long way from when he was a young, yeah, boy, and now he's this genius, and you're like, oh, he's really changed. Oh, he's much more like his brother now. And you're like, yeah, oh, much more like his brother now. But you'd forgotten that,
yeah,
twist.
Yeah, totally. Like, that's so until, funny. Really, until I read it, and I thought, oh, yes, okay, there was something. I, yeah, totally forgot about it.
That's really impressive. No, the only thing I had forgotten in this book was the Stabberind, like the ship, because I couldn't remember. I knew that the ship was something, but when it, yeah, said the ship that wasn't the ship, you know, what, yeah, is the weapon? The ship that wasn't the ship, a chair that wasn't a chair,
yeah,
the brother that wasn't the brother, or, you know,
yeah,
and it's,
yeah,
like, who is the chair maker? Am I the chair maker? He says that at the beginning, there's these, yeah, hints that drop, but it ramps up into that mystery. It ramps up into that twist really nicely. What else was I going to say about, there was another point that I was going to bring up about his journey and his brother, and their identities. I can't remember. Anyway, that's not so much. But I really love that scene at the end where it's revealed. It's sort of like, stop, why are you calling him Shredder-a-Dream?
Yeah, and it is actually...
That's not his name. Also... And it's one of those times where, like, I was listening to it as the audiobook and my blood was running cold because you had some hints there. The drone is like, oh, look at this. Look at what I've just found out in the archives over there.
Yeah. There was a thing, but even then I didn't remember.
Yeah.
But I think it was also very important is that actually the whole time we are told about these sisters.
And the chair.
And we are also told right at the beginning that the one thing that they have, like when they do the talk about, oh, we want you to go to that war once more for us.
Yeah.
And then what he is requesting is to see
his sister,
Liviata,
yeah. Yeah.
His sister. It's not even clear at the beginning who it is.
Oh, isn't it? Okay.
And he wants to see this woman, and just, it's really brilliant how it's, she appears, she's mentioned there at the beginning, and then she's mentioned in their childhood, and then really very at the very, very end, she is actually the person who reveals
yeah.
the whole twist and stuff at the end. And she's not even saying, oh, Ephemia, what are you doing here, or something?
Yeah, she's just like, don't see me again. Stop yes. bringing him back here. Yeah, yeah.
And
so she's been through this.
He's
yeah.
whinging for her. How is it, not apology? No, that she,
forgiveness. But he doesn't realize he, like I say, it's only subconsciously that he wants to go meet her. He doesn't. It's like he doesn't even understand why he needs to go and see her.
Yeah.
It's like this thing driving inside for the forgiveness, but he doesn't even know what he's being forgiven for. And, like, that's the reason why part of him is wanting to die.
Yes.
And part of him is wanting to get there. And in the end, he's kind of doing that leaving it up to chance thing. And I think that's a good thing where, like, he's so injured and he might die. And by the end of the book, you're not sure if he survives or not. And that's kind of replaying what he was doing in that spaceship when he's trying to take his helmet off in the vacuum.
Yes.
It's like, I'm not leaving up to me. Like, should I die? Should I not die? Should I get to the end of this? Should I not get to the yeah. end of this? And
he this is the weird thing. He's playing with suicide, but he's never going to just do it consciously by himself. He's always putting it to outer circumstances.
Yeah, well, the book
to
starts,
decide for him yeah. what's going to happen with him.
Well, the book starts with them they're going to set off the bomb in the city at the beginning, and they're being
yeah.
shelled from the distance, and they're like,
drunk.
Yeah, they're drunk, and he's dragging this guy. He's like, oh man, should I even? Oh, let's get him into this truck, and they go off, and they do
yeah.
that, and that little story is wrapped up at the end. And there's another great scene at the very end where it's like. Dizzy A. Smart is picking up her next Zakawi. It's like,
yeah.
oh, well, Zakawi We don't know if he's dead or not. We don't know if he, but we know he's probably not going to be working with the culture anymore. And we see this cycle starting again with Dizier Smar coming up and picking somebody else to be the next guy,
innocent man to become a wreck. What I also like is that right in the middle he has this. I don't even know. If it's a friendship or he has kind of a. Yeah, I think it's a friendship that he has with this other character. On this other ship there, the person who then
cleans tables.
What? Cleans tables?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, right. The person who cleans the table. He's just a friend, is he?
Yeah, well, he's going from one place to the next place, and you know, having sex with some people here and eating with these people here. He's going around a big ship.
Yeah.
We should talk about ship names as well.
Well, I didn't. The German ship didn't really work come up much this time.
No, it's not about
the
ships.
I'd rather talk a bit more about the drone. Because,
we'll talk about drones in later books. We get to the end of it, we can do it, because we're going to do a wrap-up episode of the whole thing. Okay, I'm going to talk about something if you can't remember who you're talking about. So, there's a guy that he meets, and this guy is like, oh, well, what do you do here? I'm just cleaning this table in this restaurant on this culture ship.
His name is Shire's Engine. And Shire's Engine.
Shire's Engine? Yeah?
Yeah, that's his name. I just tried to find the name.
Okay.
And there's again like a poem at the end.
Yeah. Oh, is that by
it's
the
a song.
Is that that's the song
Yeah.
of the guy?
Yeah. And it's somewhere said he never saw Shire's Engine again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no, that's a different person who I was thinking of, actually. Okay. There's a thing going... he says, but look, this table's clean. You know, he's cleaning a table on this spaceship. And Zakoa was like, well, why are you cleaning the table? Wouldn't a robot be able to clean the table? And he's like, yes, but I'm cleaning this table. And there's this thing, there's this cool, like, the purpose in life. And I've mentioned this, we were talking about this in a previous culture book, I can't remember, but like what are humans good for in the culture? You know, that's the question. What are they there for? And in this thing it goes, what else is human good for if not pleasure? You know, sort of like we're good for pleasure, you know, that's what we do. Humans do pleasure, humans do leisure, humans do hanging around.
Yeah.
And they're very much like, you know, cats in that way. Zakawi is a dog, you know.
Yeah.
Like in the culture, humans are cats. They sit around, they eat food, they purr. That's what they're doing. Humans from outside of the culture have purpose. They have drives. They have real, you know, like a working dog, you know, goes out and hunts or goes out and finds people, you know, in the snow looking like this. So the dogs versus cats dichotomy of humans within inside. You know, and it's like, what else is humans good for if not pleasure? And what you get is that they're good for being tools and weapons.
Yeah.
And that's what we find with humans in the culture. They don't have any purpose except when they're being used by special circumstances, when they're being used by contact, you know, and as the culture. Otherwise, they don't have a purpose, really. Because any hard work, machines can do. Any hard thinking, ships will do. Any fighting, etc., drones will do.
They don't need humans for that.
No. So what are humans? They're pleasure centers, and they're kind of a consciousness or the tools of the culture. So, did you find who you're talking about now?
Okay, so I was totally wrong with it. So the person that writes the Sakawa's song at the end is actually, I totally forgot about her. She was in the middle where he's trying to become a poet.
Yeah.
She is a poet.
Yeah.
And he never got around to reading one of her poems or something.
Yeah.
And
because she would write poems about him. She was writing a poem every day.
So and at the end you have this Sakawa song, and it finishes with a sentence saying, "The bomb lives only as it is falling."
That's a very good line.
It's really good. It kind of wraps it up pretty well.
Yeah.
And so it's actually she is a female character, and I think this is one of the only times where he actually has a relationship where he's kind of happy. I mean,
But he knows it's not going to last.
It's not going to last, and he's not a poet.
I love his technique for writing poems. He keeps track of everything he thinks and sees,
yes,
and then goes through and chops out the words, you know, like edits it down. It's quite a funny description of the way, like, you know, like a military person thinks a poem. It's like, well, of course all poetry should be written like this.
Yes, and also he's constructing something, yeah, which is also then, again, something that...
Building.
Yeah.
Like a chair.
Yeah.
Yes. So what else was it? What else was I going to say? I've got a few more notes here. Two more notes. Use of weapons, rifle, a man, a chair. Oh, yeah, I love his... he's got this plasma rifle that's his baby. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, the plasma rifle, because he can't go in there with like the most extreme culture weapons, but he's got this plasma rifle that he's very proud of. The other thing is, like, I really want to come back to the idea that he sometimes the culture sends him in to work for some people, and he doesn't know if he's on the side that's meant to win or he's on the side that's meant to lose. And you realize that, like, most of the time he's on the side that has to lose.
Yes.
So they're like, well, what does the culture think he's capable of? You know, he seems to surprise them. He always does a good job. He's always, you know, proficient, until they send him in and he's meant to win the war, and then he can't win the war. And they're like, oh, like, this is the one time that you're actually meant to be winning this. And he's like, oh, I don't care. And he's kind of lost his way at that point, you know. He's kind of, you know, after his head's been chopped off, I can't remember which one's happened at that point, and then in this battle at the end he's meant to lose, but he does too good of a job, and in the end they've got to...
Also, it's quite funny, in my second read now, I was 100% sure that at the end, when he has this idea of an, oh, we take this old spaceship, which you have,
the space shuttle thing,
and then we just drop it onto the whole court of the other guys, of the enemies, and I was 100% sure that actually took place.
No, it's just,
it never happened.
But it's like, it's funny because they're like the priests are like, oh no, we're gonna need that to get away, although they don't say that he suspects that they're gonna need that to get away. But also then they think, that's the only way we can win. Yeah, let's do it. So at the beginning, they're like, no, don't drop the spaceship as a bomb. And then at the end, like, no, really, drop the spaceship as a bomb. And he's like, no, we don't need it. We're gonna do it our own way. This is great. But like, I love the conversation where, you know, they're actually talking, like, Zakalwi and Dizier Smar are talking, and he says, I have no idea. Oh no. He says to the old president, he says, I don't know if the culture are the good guys or not. It's, you know, because he's asked,
sovereign.
Like, why are you fighting for the culture? He's like, how do you know they're the good guys? And he's like, well, I don't know if they're the good guys or not. And then later on, he has a conversation with Dizzy Esmar, which actually happens beforehand in his timeline, but in the books later on. And she's like, oh, we think we're right. We think we can even prove we're right, but we can never be sure. There are always arguments against us. And I really like this, that even the culture is ambivalent, that it's not quite sure if it's doing the right thing or not.
Yes.
And like I say, that's what the humans are there for. The humans are their conscience. The humans are their morality check. Because if it was always just machines doing what's best for machines, the machines would, you know, become replicating.
Like, they would behave like Scaphanantus Gra
when
it is defending... Is it smart?
Just over here, we'll just wipe out that planet. That planet may or may not be harmful in the future, but we're going to go for the Bush doctrine and going to take out the threat in the, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, the because they work with problems on a human level, that's the humans are kind of their conscience to do that. So yeah, I just thought that was an interesting thing. There is actually one thing which comes up, which I think is a bit below this book. This book didn't need this, but they're talking about torture. And they say, and Sma visits a place, and she says, oh, and there's this one place that I visited, and it wasn't torture. It was actually how they killed people. They killed them by putting them in a chair, and then, get this, they either gassed them or they passed a very high electric current through them, or a pellet dropped into a container beneath the seat, and like some obscure image of a commode producing fatal gas, or a cap over the head and their hands dipped in some conducting fluid to fry their brains. And you know the punchline? Yes, Ma, give us the punchline. This same state had a law that forbade, and I quote, cruel and unusual punishments. Can you believe that? And it's a very direct quote I mean, of
concerning us.
Well, of concerning United States, and it's like,
yes,
and it's like Ian and Banks going, "Oh, look over there, cruel and unusual." And this book doesn't need that. Of course, the book that we're going to be reading next, which is The State of the Art, Dizzy Asmar comes and visits America. It comes and visits Earth, you know. Yeah. So it is understandable. We know that she, like, if we'd have read the books in order, we'd have known that she'd visited Earth. But in this book, it kind of stands out as too much of a contemporary human Earth cultural reference. That is my only negative point about this whole book. Is that one paragraph and that one line?
Yeah.
Is the only thing. Literally, there's nothing else about this book which I think should be changed. Or if I was to do an edit of it, that's the only thing that I would take out. So that's my only negative comment about this. And it was a bit confusing the first time I read it, but now I'm on my third read through, and it's really good. So what else? Negative points about the book? What don't you like about it?
Still, for me, because I forgot quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
It was still quite confusing why some things had to be in it, like some story parts had to be mentioned and had to be like focused on. So,
like what?
You see, there's so many little stories in the story that you can't even remember all the little stories, and I mix them up and stuff. The only thing is that I still had this bit of confusion going on. Also, probably because I normally never read like a book like that. It's quite a chunky book, so I read it in quite some sections, and sometimes I put it aside. And
we listened to another audiobook in that same time, and you were reading a German book as well. Yeah.
So and also I stopped read. I started reading 1984. Before I started reading Use of Weapons again, and it was kind of put in that. So it is, I mean, I must admit, my reading habits are not the straightest ones, but...
Well, both of us always have, like, four books on the go.
Yeah, but still, for a book like Use of Weapons, that might not be the best way of doing it. If I could, I would just take this on a long holiday, and just a relaxed holiday, and just try to read it as...
Yeah, concentrate on one book.
Yes.
Well, that's what I did in the end, because I didn't want to keep breaking away from it. That's why, because normally I'd be reading an e-book and I'd be reading an audiobook, but they'd be different. But this time I wanted to go, like, because sometimes I would read a book in bed and I'd put that book down, and then I'd go, well, I'm not asleep yet, but I don't want to disturb you anymore, but I don't want to be looking at a screen, because looking at a screen, I don't fall asleep looking at screens very much.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, now I want to listen to something, and if I don't have a podcast that I want to listen to, I'll put on an audiobook. And normally it's a different book, so I'll finish a chapter of one book and then start, and then fall asleep listening to another chapter of a different book.
Yes.
Whereas this time I didn't switch between books. I went from reading the book to listening to the book and back
again. And that one night you read like until 4 o'clock or something?
It was quite long. Like, but it was a really good book. Like, why would I stop reading? Okay. So, anything else you want to say about it, good or bad? Except, because the only bad thing that you've got about it is your own reading habits.
I'm just really enjoying it and having fun, smiling from time to time, laughing out loud from the other times, and just really good book. It's just very well written.
Okay, then. So you're going to give it a rating?
Let me see what I have here.
What?
Somewhere I have...
On your Goodreads?
Yeah, I must have given it 5 stars.
Yeah, but it's only because you can't give half stars. Are you going to give it less than 5 stars?
4.5.
You're going to give it 4.5?
Yeah.
No, because I was going to give it 5 stars again. And now, because we average out our ratings when we're doing this, it's going to have to be at 4.75. No. You can leave it. Well, 4.75 stars. I'm giving it 5. Just so you know, my rating has not come down since the last time I read it 6 years ago.
In
2008.
I mean, it's a brilliant book. And I, why should my reading habits go and stand in front of the rating?
No, because the point is the rating that you give is purely subjective. So, there's some books which have gone up the second time I read them. The book hasn't changed. You know the quality of the book, there's nothing changed about it. But my personal situation or the way I've read it or books I've read in between have made me think more or less of it. You know, so. So, look, you gave Consider Phlebas 4 stars, and... Oh, no, that's... No, you gave that 3 stars.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not quite sure, because I obviously changed the rating a bit. I think last time I gave it 4 stars as well.
And now you've bumped it up to 5 stars.
Yeah, and I think I should just leave it with 4 stars. Or what, like
use of weapons
on Goodreads?
Okay, because well, just put in the top of your review, just put actually 4.5 stars. You know? That's what lots of people do. They'd say it's not quite a 5-star book, but it's better than 4 stars. So okay, 4.75 stars between us. That's it. So the next book, as I've already mentioned, that we're going to be reading in our culture, Ian M. Banks culture series read along thing. Is, let me just get this up here. So we've done State of the Art, and we're going like to see what Earth's point is in this. We'll read the whole, because it's actually a short story collection, so we'll read all of the short stories. There's 8 short stories, but I think we'll concentrate mostly on Dizier Smar's trip to California.
Sounds really fun.
Maybe it's not California, but I know she comes to Earth.
Okay.
And it's funny because then you get the interaction between the culture and Star Trek, which I remember is really good fun. Yeah.
Great. So I'm reading this one as a German paper book from the library where I just got it today.
Yeah. And also we got another book which you got because you were wanting to look at, because you were going through my 5-star books to see which books I've rated 5 stars. Moore's Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. And it's, what is it, like €20 to get them?
It's just available as a hardcover.
Yeah, which just, in Germany.
Was published in 2011 or something, really recent book. Or as a paperback from the 70s.
Which means, as we know we did with Dune,
as an abridged version.
Yeah.
And not very well translated.
But not even a proper abridged version, but like with Dune, it's like a version which doesn't even tell you that it's abridged.
No, it never says on the book cover, hey, look, this is an abridged version. No, it's just hiding it from you.
So we're going back through, I know this is a weird thing, but we're going through some of our top-rated books of all time. Like I say, there's not many books have got 5 stars here on the SFBRP, but like again, why wouldn't we be reading those more
why
often?
Why not picking the best book?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I also have Ready Player One as an audiobook, which I probably will go at some point.
Some people are trying to get me to read that.
And you, it was like, this is not one of your favourites, so I will.
No, I've never read it.
You never read it?
No, no. It's narrated by Will Wheaton, and after Red Shirts, I said I'm not going to...
just read the book, so there's no narrator.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. And then, we got that one. I'm listening to the second book in the... by Jason Hoff, he did the Darwin Elevator, and now it's the Exodus Towers in the second book. The story picks up literally like minutes after the last one finished. You know, so it's just a continuation of the same story of this trilogy. So that's going to be fun. I'm already enjoying that. And
I will finish 1984.
Well, great.
I will start the other ones.
Flowers for Algernon, etc.
Yes.
Anyway, I think that's about it. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. You can become my friend on Goodreads, and also Juliana's friend, and that's really good if you do that, because then we can see what you think of the books that we're reading ourselves and reviewing. So, and it's, if you want me to read a book, one of the best ways to do it is to post it in the forum thread on the SFBRP listeners group on Goodreads. I know it's complicated to say that, but if you get on to Goodreads, search for SFBRP listeners, and there's a thread on there called books I would like to see reviewed. And if you post it there, and then other people also say, yay, you should read this, the more people who pile on and say you should read it, the more likely it is.
Yeah.
Like someone actually said, hey, you should read, that was somebody else who said you should read the Martian as well. Someone actually mentioned that more recently. I can't remember. Yeah, but some people on there said you should replay Ready Player One, and other people said no, you shouldn't.
There's another friend request there.
Really, I've got another friend request.
Maybe so, people are actually listening what we're talking about.
Yes.
Right now.
So Tim says, "I just found your podcast and I'm currently catching up. I'm particularly interested in fantasy books. Also, I'm a fellow juggler, recreational, working on my 5-ball cast decade. Thanks for the entertainment, Tim. You are now my friend on Goodreads." And thanks for all the other messages. Some people have said, hey, what was it? There was this thing that said, for your information, I wasn't convinced at first, but I'm getting more enjoyment from the podcast with Juliana in attendance. Love it. And somebody else has seconded. So that's good.
Thank you.
We're actually getting better. Like when we first started, we hadn't practiced doing podcasts together, but now we're practiced at doing podcasts together. So now we're better. And that's always what happens. If you practice something, you get better. And I think our podcasts are getting better. And from the look of it, longer. We talked for, we did, no, because we did like 10 minutes of
Yeah, book. The beginning was a bit more introduction.
Yeah, a bit more talking about books that we'd read, and then we talked about the book for an hour, and now we've done 10 minutes of wrap-up. So, what else? Yeah, my blog, lukeburge.com, and also on YouTube, you can see some stupid video projects that I'm working on with juggling at the moment, which most people probably wouldn't be able to work out what's going on.
You can't do your next book. I can't move.
Yesterday I juggled so much. Like today my arms are falling off. I did this video where I had to juggle two balls in one hand.
It's nothing that the people listening there don't, they're not interested in that.
I've got a hard life.
Aww.
My arms are aching from juggling too much. Aww. Anyway, that's it for me. Oh, and email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email. Someone sent a very good email about The Martian, and he says, it would have been great if Watney had discovered a Martian fossil by the end. And then I got down to the bottom of the email. And he's like a professor in molecular biology. No, what is it? Molecular chemistry and biology or something like that. I was like, yeah, well, we're not all biologists. We don't all want...
Botanists
and you don't. I mean, it would have been fun if he did find a fossil and then have to put it in his, and then he had to fly out with that fossil because that was going to be the most important fossil. Yeah. He wouldn't. He'd have just left it behind. It wouldn't have affected the story at all. So I understand why they didn't leave that stuff in. Anyway, that's it for me. Say goodbye, Julianne.
Goodbye.
And we'll catch you next time.